Welcome, everyone, to another Weber training teleclass. My name is Jim Gauthier. I'm an infection control practitioner in Kingston, Ontario. I work at Providence Care, and I'm also past president of CHICA Canada, the national organization here in Canada for infection prevention and control professionals. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Raghu Pattaya, who will be speaking to us today on the rationale for dental infection control. Dr. Pattaya is a graduate in dental surgery from India, and he completed a Master's of Public Health residency at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He was the first recipient of the Johnson & Johnson Medical Postdoctoral Fellowship in Infectious Disease Control and Dentistry Award at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. He has conducted numerous research projects and presented over 100 original research abstracts. He's published multiple book chapters, research papers, reviewed papers, and has authored multiple newsletters, articles, and columns in magazines and journals. He is a reviewer for the Journal of Dental Education, the Journal of the American Dental Association, and the International Dental Journal. Dr. Pattaya has been an invited speaker on dental infection control and safety in the United States, India, Mexico, United Kingdom, Taiwan, Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, India, Italy, and Russia, which is quite a list of countries. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Pattaya.
Thank you, and thank you for this opportunity. And let's start off with the second slide, the objectives. The objectives of this module basically is to provide the rationale for practice of dental infection control. What we address in this module is the recent history of infection control, roots of disease transmission, application of universal standard or additional precautions, biases towards the care of infectious patients, which is the new emerging topic in infection control. Then we also address common levels of decontamination and practical applications of Spalding's classification. And then we can end it with a little bit of do's and don'ts that don't fall in any particular module. Okay, next slide, please. When we talk about dental safety can be broken up into two parts. I mean, at least I break it up into two parts. One is infection control, which is basically, which covers both the patient and the healthcare provider. Then the other is occupational safety, which basically are standards that cover healthcare providers from acquiring infections or injuries. In infection control, if you look at the red box out there, the common topics are the rationale, hand washing, hand care, common infectious diseases, personal protective equipment, use of latex products and latex sensitivity, use of surface barriers, then use and misuse of germicides, instrument reprocessing, then dental unit water lines, which includes environmental biofilms that contaminate the dental water systems, methods of controlling the biofilm growth and also the planktonic microbes in the water, which we use for dental treatment. Then look at also compatibility of these agents, which we use for controlling biofilms and cleaning the water, with composite bonding to dentin and enamel. Then we also talk, we can also address later infection control and dental radiology, both conventional and digital radiology. And then there are other modules on infection control and dental informatics. When we look at the green box on the left side, which is occupational safety, most common modules would be bloodborne pathogen standards in the United States, and I'm sure it is similar both in Europe and in Canada. Hazard communications or chemical hazards in the workplace, building and equipment safety, and nitrous oxide safety. Then, of course, there's the management aspect of quality assurance and maintenance of records and training logs and so on. Let's go to the next slide. Infectious diseases has changed the course of history. You know, if you look at it, there's an image of Francisco Pizarro and Hernan Cortes on, money. And if you look at the picture on the right, it is the first meeting of Cortes and Montezuma in Mexico City. You know, when the Spaniards first came into Mexico, of course, they were always trying to find two things. One is they were trying to find El Dorado, which is the mythological city of gold. And they also had another objective to their missions, which was conversion of the natives into Christianity. So when Hernan Cortes first came to Tenochtitlan, which is today's name for Tenochtitlan is Mexico City, the ruler of that city-state was Montezuma. He became a guest of Montezuma for a little while, and then after that he had a fallout because he started dabbling in the politics of Mexico City. Montezuma threw him out, but Hernan Cortes comes back with about 2,500 conquistadors and decimates over 100,000 Thunderbird warriors. 2,500 Spaniards, even though they had, guns and so on, it's a really tall order to decimate about 100,000 Thunderbird warriors who are really strong, able-bodied warriors. What happened was the first time when Hernan Cortes came, he brought a disease of the old world, which is smallpox. And as you know, smallpox affects everybody. But it really hurts and maims the adult population. So in essence, most of the adult population was either suffering or were already dead by the time Hernan Cortes, attacked Montezuma. If it wasn't for smallpox, the second language in Texas, which is Spanish, would have been an old, almost dead native tongue of Mexico. It's called Nahuatl. So we would be speaking Nahuatl in Texas instead of speaking Spanish. Let's move on to the next slide. Why are we doing all this? We need to control bloodborne pathogens and other hazards in the dental clinic. Firstly, dentistry, as opposed to general medicine, is predominantly a surgical field. Most of the time, we touch blood and saliva, or saliva mixed with blood. There's a constant risk of exposures to bloodborne pathogens because we're constantly handling sharps and doing pretty hard work, actually, in the mouth, in a very small work area. There's a risk of exposure to saliva and blood during patient care for the healthcare workers. There's also a risk of cross-contamination between patients, and we can also, as dentists who are infected sometimes, we can also transfer infections from ourselves to the patients. So, apart from these pathogens, there are also exposures to chemicals, dust, and mist. That's why we need to take precautionary measures in making the practice safe for both the healthcare provider as well as the patient. Next slide. Infection control is not something new. One of my heroes out here is Ignaz Semmelweis. You know, he was a physician. He was a neonatologist in Austria. And he said that childbed fever was caused by physicians and medical students who walked in from the autopsy rooms or the morgues without washing their hands. They'd come and handle the neonates or the infants. And what he showed was when he asked them to wash their hands before touching the babies. He showed reduction in the in childbed fever. But during that time, people were not, I mean, nobody knew what germs were and so on. So even his supervisor, the director of the hospital, thought he had crazy ideas and got him interned into a state-owned asylum. And that actually broke Semmelweis's spirit, you know. And he basically, you know, he went back to his home country as a broken man. You know, during the time of Semmelweis, people were not open to new ideas. But just about 10 or 15 years later, Joseph Lister in Glasgow General Hospital showed similar outcomes by using, you know, carbolic acid to wash one's hands, soaps made of carbolic acid, and so on. And then what he showed was he could control or reduce the hospital infections in Glasgow General Hospital. By then, I think the physicians, you know, had an open mind, or they were kind of sensitized to the work of what Semmelweis had done. Now they made Joseph Lister a hero. You know, today we have even a mouthwash that has got nothing to do with Joseph Lister, and it's called Listerine. You know, and we're not talking, I mean, these happened within the past 200 years, you know. But if you go back to almost about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, you know, there were ancient civilizations that practiced varying levels of infection control. You know, if you look at around the 400 to 800 BC, there was a surgeon called Sushruta from India, and he's written quite a few surgical techniques, and he had designed quite a few surgical instruments, most of which are still being used today. I mean, slight modifications of those. What he used to do was he used to fumigate the patient care room, you know, before surgeries. He used to flame the instruments before he laid an incision. He also advocated clipping nails, hair, and keeping your hands and body clean before doing the surgery. So infection control is not something really new. It was there in the past, but disappeared in the Dark Ages, and then again made a re-entry in the 20th century. Next slide. In the mid-80s, after the HIV pandemic, or during the HIV pandemic, the Centers for Disease Control of the United States and similar bodies both in Europe and in Canada and other advanced medical countries started adopting higher standards in patient care, basically with respect to infection control. These standards were not written in the 80s. Most of these were actually written during the late 50s and early 60s due to hepatitis B infections, and most of these infections that were caused by dentists. In fact, one of my professors who taught me when I was in the School of Public Health, he was an infectious disease epidemiologist. His PhD dissertation was on an oral surgeon, a cluster caused by an oral surgeon, a cluster of hepatitis B. So the standards were written then, but nobody followed the standards with vigor. They only started doing this after, HIV pandemic, which, you know, had a social connotation to it rather than purely a medical connotation. So ever since 1983 onwards, most countries are now following or are developing these safe standards for patient care. Next slide. In the past, we used to use a word called prevention, infection prevention. Infection prevention is basically a tall order. prevention is an absolute term. That means you can stop all the infections. But in reality, we cannot stop all the infections. You know, even if you use a new disinfectant, the microbes tend to develop resistance to it. If you develop a new antibiotic, microbes tend to develop resistance to them. So all we can do is we can bring in practices and methods and techniques to reduce the risks or reduce the total number of these conditions. That's why it's better to use the term control rather than using the term prevention. Next slide. With respect to dentistry, you know, if you look at this black box, think of it as a dental clinic. On the left side, you have the patient. On the right side, you have the dentist and clinical staff. Patients come into the clinic. Dentist and staff comes into the clinic. They have contact prior to coming into the clinic with the world outside, their own little microcosms. Then within the clinic, they do get in contact with the patients. They can acquire diseases from the patient. They can transfer diseases to the patient. They can transfer diseases between patients and between themselves, you know, purely working in a clinic. Now, our responsibility is not what happens outside the clinic, but our responsibility is what happens inside the clinic. So in the next slide, we look and see, you know, we can't do much about patients getting infectious diseases into the clinic, you know, but we can try and prevent it from going out of the clinic to their families. We can try and control the transfer of disease between a patient and the dentist or between patients by adopting infection control measures. And with respect to ourselves, you know, once we are done with practice for the day, you know, we need to clean up, we need to wash our hands, we need to get rid of the barriers or personal protective equipment which we wear. If they are disposable, dispose them. If they are reusable, put them out to wash, and then we go back home clean. So that's just an example of what we can do. Next slide, roots of disease transmission. There are although there are many, many new roots or expansions to this old four-level roots, we'll just talk a little bit about percutaneous, contact, inhalation, and indirect contact. Percutaneous is when, you know, a sharp instrument that has possibly come in contact with microbes breaks into your skin or the patient's skin, and then the microbes are transmitted through the skin into the flesh and blood. The risk of disease transmission through percutaneous means is high. That means you don't have to have a very huge load. You can have a smaller load of microbes, but purely because it comes into in contact with blood and the inner surfaces of inner aspects of your body, the probability of disease is much higher. Contact is the next level. It is not as high as percutaneous, but with respect to mucosa, of your eye, of your nose, of your mouth, if you have a splash or spatter of fluids which bounce off the patient's mouth and carry those microbes and come in contact with your mucosa, you are susceptible to infections. So I would look at percutaneous and contact as a fairly high risk in dentistry. The third level is inhalation, where you could have microbes that are suspended in aerosols, bioaerosols, or it could be a droplet by a patient coughing, and then that droplet could actually be inhaled, and it could lodge into your alveolus of your lung. They could get infected. Example would be TB. But the risk is not that high as contact or percutaneous routes. The last one is indirect contact. Indirect contact, it's normally because of bad clinical practices. You know, suppose you know, somebody coughs or sneezes or, you know, there's saliva or blood on a surface, and if you, by mistake, touch that surface and then transfer it onto your mucosa of your eye, sometimes people do that, then you could get an eye infection. You know? So that's fomites. So these are the four basic levels or routes of disease transmission. Next slide. The most recent Centers for Disease Control guidelines on dental infection control, they talk a little bit about restrictions of clinical duties. Now, this is not a mandate, or this is not enforced. This is what you should want to practice within your own institution or within your own clinic. Suppose you have conjunctivitis. Should you impose restrictions on yourself? Yes, you should. You know, how long do you impose restrictions of clinical duties? Until the discharge ceases. Similarly, staph infection, strep infection, all of these have restrictions. You know, for staph infections, until lesions have healed. For strep A, until 24 hours after treating, effective antibiotic therapy. Viral respiratory infections, until acute symptoms resolve. For TB, if a person has got active TB, there is restrictions. I mean, basically, it's a public health concern. So there are restrictions, and one should not be involved in clinical duties until treated and deemed non-infectious. That is, they probably would put them on multiple medications, and then hopefully within a month, 4 to 6 weeks, there should be some amount of resolution so that they won't find any bacteria, you know, using a throat swab. Now, if you're under care and then you have active TB, but you've been deemed to go back into the community, you know, you can go and practice. That means you do have TB, you're being treated, but you're not infectious. Okay. The other one is, you know, you could show positive for a TB skin test, but you may not have active disease. So there, again, you don't have any restrictions. Now, if you have influenza, yes, you have restrictions until the date you're asymptomatic. Next slide. Even in America, you know, even in Texas, Dallas, Plano, there sometimes are outbreaks in schools. You know, little children come home with lice in their hair, pediculosis. Now, inadvertently, sometimes, you know, adults get lice in their hair from the children, or, you know, I work at Baylor College of Dentistry, and our school is, you know, provides care to a huge amount of underserved people, and I do see lice. I mean, I do see people with symptoms of lice. You know, we do treat homeless people also within the clinics. So if we pick up lice, we should restrict ourselves and only get back into the clinic until we are treated and we don't have any lice in our hair. Herpetic whitlow, orofacial herpes, varicella, all these have restrictions. Shingles, yes, you do have restrictions. Hepatitis B, E antigen positive, yes, you have restrictions. You know, if you are a person who is a carrier, basically what you have is you have an expert panel that reviews your medical condition. And they keep an eye on how the disease in you is progressing. After a certain level, if it's not controlled well, they won't let you to go back into practice. Similarly, for HIV, you also have a similar panel. That's what we do in the U.S. I mean, we've had students in the past, we have had faculty in the past who were HIV seropositive, and the panel kept, monitored their health, and if they were found to be, you know, deteriorating in health, they would relieve them from clinical duties and give them something else to do. Next slide. Measles, mumps, rubella, pertussis, yes, we have restrictions. Of course, for diarrhea, enteroviral infections, and hepatitis A, if you're suffering from it, you know, if you have acute symptoms, please don't go to work. I mean, I wouldn't go to work. Most people don't come to work anyways. The reason why we have to restrict ourselves is, number one, we go into the clinic when we are sick. We can spread what we have to our colleagues and to the patients. And this has happened quite often, even in our institution. Sometimes, you know, we all of us have to take flu vaccines, but sometimes some people, you know, the flu vaccine doesn't work in some of them, and you can actually see them affected. But we have a huge clinical load. We think that we have to go to work, and then we go to work, and then we might infect a patient. Another condition was SARS outbreaks. At that time, you know, it created hell because some people who fell sick were forced to come to work because they were patients. And when those people came to work, they spread it to the other staff. So it's a good idea to understand these conditions and understand what kind of restrictions you should self-impose so that you can keep your clinical area safe. Next slide. You know, for dentistry, standard precautions and universal precautions are the same. Of course, there are additional precautions, which is an extra measure during times of, you know, outbreaks, disease outbreaks or epidemics, such as in SARS or bird flu or so on. Excuse me. You know, universal precautions means to use a certain amount of protective measures, such as using disinfectants, using personal protective equipment across the board for everybody, irrespective of whether they are they have, you know, what you call a history, or they give a history of infectious diseases, or they do look infectious. Infection control in this situation with respect to universal precautions should be based on the type of procedure you're performing. Suppose I'm going to only be taking out the sutures from a patient's mouth. All I need to wear is a pair of gloves. But if I find the same patient coughing and sneezing, you know, I might want to wear a mask and a gown. You know, so that is additional precautions. Now, in situations where you have, like how we had the H1N1 influenza, most of us had to wear a mask. We even saw patients wearing masks and coming in because they didn't want to sneeze or cough and spread the germs. So don't base your infection control purely on the medical history of infectious diseases of a patient or how the patient looks. You know, looks can be deceiving. So base your infection control practice depending on the type of procedure you're going to perform. Okay. Next slide. Recently, in the past 10 years, rather, I conducted multiple surveys, you know, of multiple countries. And then I did a repeat of those surveys in some of the countries again. And what I found that we as a dental profession are fairly biased, you know. So what is bias? It's a skewed approach. You know, it's a systematic error. It's an error in judgment. You know, it's when you don't understand the true picture, you just, you know, judge a book by its cover. It precedes the act of discrimination, and it brings about inequality. Some of the common biases we see in day-to-day living is, you know, a parent's affection to a child. Even if the child is a runt, the parent, you know, tends to overlook some of the bad qualities of the kid just because they're related by blood. Another one is we sometimes as educated people are more judgmental, you know, about people who are not as well educated or who don't seem to look educated. So In this situation, we need to take a more scientific approach towards how we assess a patient, how we treat a patient, how we behave with the patient, and we should try and avoid discrimination. You know, both practicing dentists and dental faculty have shown varying degrees of biases towards infectious patients. From the recent studies we've done, as well as studies from all over the world, in spite of regulations and education in infection control and occupational safety, there still exists a gap in understanding standard precautions. Most of this is due to influence by stigma, you know, towards infectious patients. Let's talk a little bit of some data which I personally am familiar with. We did a survey of 8 countries, including the U.S. And if you look at the top one in the slide, which says evidence, universal precautions, standard precautions, 1998 to 2004. This is one survey we did. The first question was, hepatitis B and HIV status of a patient is always known. Now, nobody knows whether every patient has got hepatitis B or HIV. You only get to know after you've done a blood test. If it's an HIV patient who comes and declares that he's an HIV patient, yes, you know that's an HIV patient. But the ones who don't know, I mean, there are more people who don't know that they are HIV seropositive than those who know they are HIV seropositive in some of these countries. So, South Korea and the U.S., 62 to 64% of the respondents said that they always knew the HIV status of these patients, or the infectious status of these patients, which is wrong. All patients to be treated alike, irrespective of infectious disease. In South Korea, only 36% said that they need to be treated alike, irrespective of infectious diseases. That means, you know, the other side, the 64%, were fairly biased. Medical history and appearance dictates the level of infection control. You know, Philippines, South Korea, and the U.S. I mean, U.S., I'm talking of, we have been bombarded with infection control lectures. We've seen so many patients. We've got so many regulations. But even in spite of that, 72% felt that medical history and appearance dictates the level of infection control. Next slide. Double gloving, which is wrong, is more appropriate for treatment of infectious patients. Almost all the countries showed that more than 50% of them felt that, you know, they needed to double glove. Nobody has a right to refuse care for infectious patients. But again, in the U.S. and in South Korea, which are medically advanced countries, you know, over 50% of them felt that they had the right to refuse care. Okay. But almost every single country out here felt that they needed more training in infection control and safety. In a recent survey which I did in India, which was from 2010, only 75% of the dentists were comfortable in treating patients with infectious diseases. About 58% felt that they needed to double glove or use additional precautions. 83% wanted to double glove. They felt that they needed to wear a mask, an eyewear, gloves, and a gown for every single procedure, which is not right. You know, if you have splash or spatter, you need to wear a full PPE, which is eyewear, mask, gown, and gloves. But if you're just removing a suture, you just need a pair of gloves. So, but here, they felt that 72% felt that they needed to wear full PPE. Now, this is something new, which I didn't realize, you know. Dentists in India were scheduling infectious patients on a different time or a different day. That was kind of new to me. And so 32% of the respondents in this survey said that they scheduled infectious disease patients on separate days and times. And 52% said that at least once they had refused care for patients with sexually transmitted diseases or blood-borne diseases. A good thing was only about 16% felt that they had the right to refuse care. But 22% had stated that they had refused care for infectious disease patients because other so-called non-infectious patients did not want to come to a clinic which was treating infectious patients. Now, one of the driving factors in India, at least, India slowly kind of opening its eyes towards infection control, is not because of, you know, me going and helping them write the standards or educating them or people from abroad coming and educating them in infection control. It is a lot of the expatriate Indians, you know, from India, Canada, or Europe, or Australia, when they go back to India, they do access dental care. And then the first thing they ask the dentist is, are you following good standards in infection control? And then most dentists also say that most Indians of foreign origin or foreigners who come for dental care are more demanding of infection control and safety. So, you know, it's one way or the other. They have to improve in infection control. Next slide. So, a long story short, biases do exist. Biases will always exist, but our whole goal is to reduce it to an absolute minimum. You know, most of the time, people are biased because they're not knowledgeable enough of infection control. You know, not knowledgeable about infectious diseases and the limitations of spread of infectious diseases. So what I hope all of you would do is go back and educate your neighbors, educate your students, educate your friends who are in healthcare, not to be biased towards infectious patients, but to use the proper precautions needed for treating them. Next slide. You know, with respect to procedures, you know, there are basic three basic measures which we follow in infection control. The first level is sanitization. The second level is disinfection. The third level is sterilization. You know, there's a word called decontamination, which is used very commonly in infection control. Decontamination, per McGraw-Hill Concise Dictionary of Modern Medicine, is use of physical or chemical means to remove, inactivate, or destroy bloodborne or other pathogens on a surface or item to the point where they are no longer capable of transmitting infectious particles and the surface or item is rendered safe for handling, use, or disposal. So, next slide. Let's talk a little bit about sanitization. Sanitization is a very simple process, you know. When we eat food, we take our dishes to the sink, we soak it, we wash it with soap and water. So what we've done there is we've pretty much cleaned the plate for reuse. So sanitization is a process of physically cleaning to reduce the quantity of microbes and bioburden. So how do we achieve this? We can use soap and water to wash or wipe down a surface or an instrument. Okay, we have to sanitize it. We have to remove the bioburden. We have to remove the bio load or the microbes on it. We can't remove everything, but we can remove most of it, you know. So sometimes a disinfectant itself can be used as a sanitizer. You spray or wet a surface with a disinfectant, and then when you wipe out the disinfectant on the surface, it essentially removes most of the microbes. Okay. So another form of sanitization is using an ultrasonic cleaner to clean instruments. So use an ultrasonic solution, and then you put your instruments in the ultrasonic machine, and then you turn it on for a while, it gets cleaned. Before you disinfect or you sterilize anything, the first step you should have achieved is you should have sanitized that surface or an instrument. Next level. The next level is disinfection. It is a process to kill all vegetative organisms, but not necessarily bacterial endospores. You know, you could use a surface disinfectant, or you can use an immersion disinfectant, you know, to kill microbes. So before you disinfect, you should have already sanitized the surface. Okay, you should have removed most of the microbes through sanitization, and then you go ahead and use the disinfection process to reduce the microbes. So a germicide, a use of X-rays, use of ultraviolet rays, are some of the methods of disinfection. To disinfect impressions, you know, you can rinse out the impression once it's made with underflowing water, which is a step of sanitization. You spray a when you shake off the water, you spray a disinfectant on it, leave it for the TB kill time, and then you rinse the thing out again to remove the germicide, and then it's ready for use. So, next level and next slide is sterilization. This is the highest level of microbial control. Sterilization is a process to kill all bacterial and viral contaminants, including bacterial endospores. It also includes fungi too. Excuse me. There are chemical measures. There are chemical immersion sterilants, there's chemiclaves, there's ethylene oxide, there's glass, gas plasma, and then there are physical methods such as steam under pressure as an autoclave, dry heat, rapid heat transfer, and radiation. Now let's talk, next slide please. Now let's talk a little bit about Spalding's classification. Spalding was a researcher in the Centers for Disease Control, and he had developed a rubric looking at what type of surfaces need what type of decontamination. And Walter Bond and Marty Favero, who also were working in Hospital Inspections Division of the CDC, modified it and refined this. And then finally, we landed up with the Spalding's classification. What we're talking here is there are four basic type of surfaces. Okay, the closest are the most dangerous ones, are the critical surfaces and semi-critical surfaces. Then you have the non-critical surfaces, and then you have the environmental surfaces. The critical and semi-critical surfaces are items that fall under that category. Those two categories must be sterilized. The non-critical surfaces or items must be sanitized and disinfected. Environmental surfaces must just be maintained, you know, with housekeeping measures. Next slide. Let's look at what critical is. According to Spalding's classification, critical items are those items that pierce the skin or mucosa. You know, as we said earlier, those items that you know, with respect to routes of transmission, all things that can pierce mucosa or skin, examples are explorers, scalpels, scalers, burrs, and other sharps, those all fall under the critical category, and they all must be sterilized, or they must be sterile, single-use, disposable items. In this, next slide, please. In this, you see a picture which has got, you know, explorers, scalers, probes. You have single-use, sterile single-use disposable needles. And I also put a anesthesia carpule out there. The reason I put this here is most of these reusable items can be reused. The ones such as a carpule and the needles, after one use, you have to throw it away. You cannot use it on another patient. The next level is semi-critical. These are non-sharp items that enter the oral cavity. Okay. These items need not, you know, pierce or injure the mucosa. The intent of these instruments is not to pierce or injure the mucosa, but it crosses the lips into the mouth. So anything that goes into the mouth, which doesn't pierce, which doesn't have an intent of piercing or hurting the mucosa, such as amalgam condensers, mirrors, and handpiece, all these fall under semi-critical, and they too must be sterilized. The next slide, please. If you look at this picture, I have the first two items are, you know, a high-volume evacuator and a saliva ejector. Those are plastic items. They needn't be sterile. They have to be kept clean. There should be clean supplies. Okay? Then you have a handpiece. So the first two are single-use disposable clean supplies. Handpiece that needs to be autoclaved, a mirror, amalgam condenser, amalgam carrier, all these need to be sterilized. So if you can reprocess anything, if an instrument can withstand reprocessing, go ahead and reprocess it. If it is a single-use disposable, non-sterile item, use it once and throw it away. The third level is non-critical. These are items that do not enter the oral cavity, but are in close proximity to patient care. They're always touched very commonly with dirty gloves and so on. These items need to be disinfected, or in the absence of disinfection, you can use impervious surface barriers. Examples are, next slide, these are the bracket table, chair controls, and so on. So what we practice in our school is we use surface barriers, and we only touch the surfaces that are barriered with dirty gloves. Okay. After treating the patient, we dispose these plastic barriers, and we put another barrier on. But at least once or twice a day, we go ahead and disinfect with the surface disinfectant. Next slide. Environmental surfaces. Environmental surfaces are those surfaces such as walls, floors, and tabletops, you know, office table and so on. Those things don't need to be disinfected. They just need to be kept clean, you know, sweeping, swabbing, and gentle housekeeping. Those are the things that are needed. Now, let's talk a little bit about do's and don'ts. Let's go to the next slide. You know, while you're treating a patient, you'll be wearing full personal protective equipment, you'll be wearing contaminated gloves, you'll be carrying contaminated items. When you're doing these, don't touch common surfaces. Common surfaces are door handles, light switches, you know, which are touched by people in the other people in the office who are not in clinical care. Don't touch them with contaminated or dirty gloves. No. Even if you're wearing clean gloves, don't touch those surfaces, because other people will perceive that you're contaminating those common surfaces. Also, if you're wearing full personal protective equipment, don't go outside of your clinical treatment area and sit in common areas with your personal protective equipment on. It doesn't look good, firstly. And secondly, you know, what's the use? You're not going to be harmed by any flying debris or patients or anything out there. So try to restrict most of the PPE use within the patient care area. Suppose you want to come into the waiting area and sit down, get rid of your PPE and then go and sit down in the patient care area. Here's an example of just showing you that you're not supposed to eat or drink anything in the clinic. I was just wearing, this is a joke, I was wearing gloves and I was trying to eat into an Oreo. Basically, in a clinical area or in a patient care area, you're not supposed to handle your contacts, you know, for your eyes. You're not supposed to put on or start using makeup or anything. You're not supposed to eat or drink anything in the a patient care area, you know, in the clinic, that is. You can do that, you know, in the waiting area if you want. You can do that in the clinic's kitchen if you want, if you have a kitchen out there, but don't do this in the patient care area. Another thing which I commonly have noticed within our school and outside, you know, in other countries, is people do wear a mask, but it'll be below the nose. You know, the mask will be below the nose, and it doesn't serve the purpose out there. So if you're going to wear a mask, you know, wear the mask properly over the nose and pinch it in such a way that it fits snugly. A dress code and appearance. You know, if you have facial hair, keep it short and keep it well-maintained. And also, if you have long hair, irrespective of gender, try to harness the hair, you know, either with a bonnet or tie the hair back so that when you're bending over a patient, your hair is not, the bangs or the hair is not hanging over your patient's face. Another common problem which I come across, and I've been on many, you know, sat on many hearings between a between an employee and a lawyer and the clinic, it's normally the length of nails. If you look at this picture where you're seeing the nails, you know, that is an adequate length. If it's anything above that, it's going to damage your gloves. You know, it's not a gender-based issue. It is just that the longer your nails are, it's going to damage your gloves faster. You know, now if you look into your palm of your hand, hold it up to your face and look into your palm of your hand, and if you don't see the nails, you know, peeking over the tips of your fingers, that's an acceptable length. Now, the next slide shows a person having slightly longer nails than totally trimmed nails. Even this length is quite damaging to the gloves. Okay. An example of the same in the next slide, you can see the nails peeking over the tips of your fingers. One of the things we commonly come across in clinical practice is injuries to your hands, you know, hands, finger, and so on. So if you have an injury, use, you know, wash your hand, apply a medication and put a Band-Aid, or you can use methacrylate paint you get these days. Just paint it over that injury, and then you can wear your gloves. If it's your finger, which has got a cut or so, you can use apply a dressing, use a finger cot, and then wear your gloves. So I think we've come to the end of our module, and I hand it over to Jim. Thank you. Thank you very much for your patience.
And thank you, Dr. Pattaya. That was a great presentation on infection prevention and control in the dental office. We can't open the lines up for questions. I will point out that on your last slide here, you do have contact information. So if you do have a question for Dr. Pattaya, you can email him through the contact information that's present. I did want to ask you one question that came up when I was doing a similar presentation to this locally here in Ontario. And I was talking about patients with bloodborne pathogens. And one of the chairside assistants pointed out that they treat the dental equipment differently when they know that the patient has a bloodborne pathogen. And I said, well, what do you mean, expecting that they should be treating all equipment exactly the same? And they actually autoclaved all of the equipment right from the chairside before they then tried to clean it and autoclave it again. And I was just curious, did you ever come across that in your survey that you did in India, where they actually treated the equipment differently when they knew the bloodborne status?
Yeah, with respect to India, yes, I have, and I've heard from, I go there at least about 4 or 5 times a year, and I do visit clinics, I do meet with both faculty and practitioners. Yes, they do. That's one thing. But what kind of, you know, hurts me more is I come across that in the United States. You know, at least once a month, somebody calls me and says, we just saw an HIV patient. What is the procedure we need to follow to, you know, to reprocess our instruments? What should we do for the rest of the surfaces in the clinic. I said, do exactly what you do to any other patient. I mean, you should not discriminate between an infectious patient and a non-infectious patient. What I'm trying to say is the measures which are prescribed are good for both, and they must be done irrespective of whether the patient is infectious or not. Suppose you treat a patient, don't know whether it's infectious or not. You go ahead and you reprocess all your instruments, you clean the surfaces between patients. You do exactly the same for a patient who's got HIV or, any other sexually transmitted disease or bloodborne condition. It doesn't matter. So that's what I tell them, and I tell them not to kind of, that is actually a bias. Bias.
And I was much more concerned that if you autoclave dirty equipment before you clean it, you're actually baking it on.
You're not going to be able to get
the equipment clean. And the lady I was talking to was very surprised that I would suggest that we use routine practices or standard precautions where you treat everything exactly the same. I don't find that comforting at all that you're running into the same thing. I thought we had this nailed down much better in terms of practicing standard precautions with everyone.
True. I mean, that happens worldwide. Now, another thing which I find commonly, which is a very bad practice, is, and this has not happened because of any of the standards. Whenever we are we use instruments in a patient's mouth, we have to soak it before we sonicate it, and then we have to sterilize it after it's been sonicated and washed. A lot of clinics are using a disinfectant to immerse their instruments, and keep it moist. So I asked them, why do you do that? That's not necessary. All you need is soap and water or diluted ultrasonic solution in a holding bath. That's it. But they say that, this will actually reduce the risks in case we get stuck during reprocessing those instruments. If you get stuck, there's lesser chances. I said, it's not proven. So don't use a disinfectant to immerse your instruments before you sterilize it. Just use soap and water until the instrument comes out sterile. It's contaminated, and you got to really watch out. That's all. So that's one thing which I've found also from most clinics. I'm talking of over 60-70% of the clinics I've visited out here in the U.S. They've somewhere down the line picked up this thing of immersing, using a disinfectant as a holding solution.
That is a concern. I hear what you're saying with that for sure. Well, once again, thank you very much for the presentation. I would like to point out the last two slides that are included on the PowerPoint deck. Talk about upcoming presentations for the Weber teleclasses. There's another teleclass next week. Actually, it's next Monday. And there's two presentations coming up on Clostridium difficile. Other presentations, as you will see on the slide, talking about disinfection systems, hand hygiene, and Paul has a huge and excellent lineup going on for this year. I'd also like to thank the patron sponsors of the teleclass presentations, which is Virox and the World Health Organization. Without their support, these teleclasses would not be possible. Once again, thank you all for listening in today, and I look forward to having you listen in on future teleconferences. Thank you again, Dr. Raghu Pattaya.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye now.